The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I'm very conscious that we've turned now, the Earth has turned now in such a way that it's in orbit. We're going to get more and more light. And it seems like an opportune time to talk about important things and important directions that our life can take. So I'll talk a little bit about light, but first I want to quote the Buddha. That's something that's very memorable. Maybe you won't remember anything else from the talk, but maybe you'll remember this. He said, "Don't give yourself away and don't give up on yourself." You can see it's a very powerful statement. Don't give yourself away and don't give up on yourself. So I'll pick that up again as we go through this talk. So in terms of light, the Buddha referred to wisdom as the greatest light. He said that there were four great lights back in his time, and there was the light of the sun, the light of the moon, and the light of fire. And I guess before electricity and technology, they didn't know about other things. And those three. And then the fourth one was the light of wisdom. And of those four, the foremost is the light of wisdom. The word for wisdom, panya, does not refer to knowledge in the sense of something you can learn and then know because you've learned it, like information. It refers to something that you know experientially, through your perception. And it refers to knowledge, experiential knowledge, that has to do with the liberation of the mind, with the mind becoming awake, to be enlightened, to be free. And it's remarkable to have that personal knowledge for oneself, to have as a reference point or as a home for oneself, the mind or the heart's ability to be free, and then to be able to kind of maneuver, navigate through our lives, developing that or applying that or living that in all the complexities and difficulties that life comes. And so to call this wisdom, this knowledge, light, is quite a suggestive idea, that it's like we have this flashlight or a spotlight with which we see the world, see ourselves in a way that is freeing, or that is a manifestation of freedom. To get a sense of what this might mean, a few analogies might be useful. I remember there have been times in my life, especially when I was a kid, I was so involved in reading books that I didn't notice that the evening was coming on and the light was getting darker and darker. And I would strain to try to read instead, because I was so involved in the book, and I would just be there reading, but it was a strain. And then someone like my mother would come along and turn on a light. And say, "Oh, oh, that's nice." Oh, it was like, I hadn't noticed the strain of that I was in because I was so involved in the book. But as soon as someone turned on the light, there was this relaxation that happened. Another analogy might be that of if you are riding a bike, if you grip and hold tight the brake, I think if you hold it tight enough, at least I'm not strong enough to get the bike to go, but if you hold the brake kind of half strong, I could make the bike go, but it's going to be a real effort. And I might be so interested in where I'm going that I might not notice that I was straining and pushing on that pedal until some accident happened, something unusual, that got me to release my grip. And so, oh, wow, now it's like effortless to bike on a flat piece of ground. I didn't realize there was all this drag. And so we could be so preoccupied or fixated on what we're concerned with, we don't notice how the fixation of the mind on our concerns acts as a kind of brake on the freedom, the ease of the mental life just kind of rolling along and moving along. The other analogy might be that wearing shoes which are a little bit too small, so they're tight. And if, you know, those are the shoes you were given, and you think that that's the way they're supposed to be, and so you walk for a long time with these shoes, and you think that's how it's supposed to be, and you're much more interested in where you're going than your shoes and your quality of the sensations of your feet. And so you just live contentedly with these shoes that are too small until someone says, wait a minute, try these on. And you find a pair of shoes that fit perfectly. And then, wow, this is so good. Like, they fit and it's the ease. I don't have to deal with this being contracted. So these analogies are ones where the idea being that a person is fixated or preoccupied with some focus of attention in such a way that they don't notice necessarily the strain they're under in trying to pursue that concern. And the same way can be with us. We have a lot of thoughts, ideas, preoccupations, things we're worried about, things that we want, things that we're afraid of. And as long as it's very easy to be involved in those with our thoughts, our mind, our emotions, and kind of get lost in them, preoccupied and concerned with them, then we don't get the bigger picture of the quality of the mind itself, or the awareness itself, or the heart itself that's here. And so things narrow, or things get tight, or there's a strain, until something releases it. And I've certainly sat in meditation and not really known the cost of the strain that I was under, because it was pretty mild and I get used to it, you go through daily life and don't really notice that I'm thinking about something, concerned about something, until I sit down to meditate. And then I might start noticing. But I've had times where I didn't really notice the strain, even meditating, until I got concentrated. And then something gave away in the mind, and suddenly there was a space in the mind. There was openness. There was a wider field of awareness. Ah, like the refrigerator just went off. I didn't know. Wow. And so that openness, relaxation, ease, the light goes on, the brakes go off, the shoe fits, the refrigerator goes off, all these things. That's openness and spaciousness. Is that's related to the knowledge that's the light, the wisdom light that the Buddha was focusing on. Another example for this that might help also be interesting is, I believe it works this way, and that is that space, like the space in this room, if you look, you have a big high ceiling, if you look around the space, you can look and focus and fixate your attention on the objects in the room and you really zero in, look at it, and, make a mental impression of the object. But space doesn't lend itself for the eyes to kind of get fixated on or get kind of focus, kind of a central focus, look exactly at the center of the space and just kind of really take it in. I think to take in space, perceive space of the room, the mind doesn't fixate, it kind of opens up and gets more spacious itself, a more wide angle. There's a more relaxed sense of paying attention to space, because space doesn't lend itself to having a central focus to it. Is that right enough? At least that's how it is, I think it is for me. And so the same thing with the mind. We can have objects of the mind that we're concerned with, and we don't then notice the space. But if we notice the space, it's possible in the space to be aware of the objects. And they're held in this wider field, in a sense. And so the experiential insight or knowledge that was liberating in Buddhism has a lot to do with the awareness that becomes set free from its preoccupation. It's not an easy thing to do, because our preoccupations, we don't even know we're preoccupied. It's business as usual. It's like the shoe you've gotten used to. This is how it is. This is how we navigate the world, how we figure things out, how we get what we want, how we protect ourselves. It's just that's kind of how things go. And to be able to step back from our preoccupations and see them and be free of them, it's kind of like the Buddha talked about it as as if we're stepping, pulling ourselves out of quicksand, out of mud, up onto dry ground. And so we use mindfulness for this purpose. Mindfulness practice, awareness practice, is partly a practice of freeing mindfulness, freeing awareness from what it knows, what it's aware of. So if we know that we're thinking, that's fine to know you're thinking, but to know it in such a way that we're not fixated on what we're thinking. We don't have the brakes on. There's not wind drag. There's not kind of a strain or a tightening around what we're thinking about our concerns. That's the function of mindfulness, is to really step back or relax or open up, release the holding. And mindfulness becomes mature when the awareness has become free. And some people will say, it's not necessary to experience it this way, but some people will say it's like awareness has become like spacious, like space, very broad and expansive. But this quality of the mind that's not fixated, not caught, not stuck. So this is called, this is the greatest light to have, the light of the mind, the light of awareness that can be turned on. And some people will actually feel that the difference between when they get preoccupied in thoughts, it's kind of like the mind goes dark. And when the mindfulness gets turned on, it's kind of like now there's more, it's translucent or radiant, or there's light in there, openness. So the Buddha said, don't give yourself away and don't give up on yourself. So I want to read somewhat famous parts of it, this passage, of a conversation that supposedly happened in the time of the Buddha between a king and a queen. They were married. It seems, at least the story, to me, it makes a little bit more power to it or something. If you think of this king as being rather full of himself. You know, a king is, you know, has all this power and center of attention and can do whatever. Back in ancient world, you know, they were kind of, you know, totalitarian, so they could do whatever they want, and everyone had to kind of, if you're already kind of an arrogant guy, you know, it's great to be a king, because that really, you know, so that's kind of, this is kind of this guy, right? I don't know if it's true, but this is. So the king says to the queen, "Is there anyone more dear to you than yourself?" Now, what should the right answer be, right? Or what should the expected answer be from the king? Who is more dear to you than yourself? You can imagine, you know. And so the queen says, "No, your majesty, there is no one more dear to me than myself." She then asked him the same question. "Is there anyone more dear to you than yourself?" "No," said the king, "there's no one more dear to me than myself." So this was a significant enough exchange on the part of the, for the king, maybe because he got the unexpected answer from the queen. He went to find the Buddha. And he told the Buddha of the exchange. And then understanding the importance of this, the Buddha then said, and he said it in verse, "If you surveyed the entire world, you would find no one more dear than yourself. Since each person is most dear to him or herself, those who love themselves should not bring harm to anyone." So it's an interesting turn here. So first he says, yes, everyone is most dear to themselves. No one, you can't find anyone. Now, I'm sure that some of you here even will think of there are people in your lives that you know, maybe you have children, who you think is more dear than yourself, more important for you and all that. But you might want to hold that kind of lightly, that idea, and maybe consider there's another possibility, the Buddha seems to be championing the idea that it's appropriate for each person to hold themselves as most dear, most important, most who you most kind of love in a sense. Is that selfishness? Is he reinforcing the selfishness of the king? Probably not. But then the Buddha does this interesting twist in the conversation, which, again, it's, you know, kind of powerful thing to say to the king who has, you know, a big army and can chop anybody's head off and, back, you know, has his power over other people's lives. Since each person is most dear to oneself, those who love themselves should not bring harm to anyone. So there's something about if everyone holds himself dear, if everyone treasures themselves or loves themselves, you don't want to harm what people love. You don't want to, since you love yourself, like you love yourself, other people love themselves. And that makes them somehow, you know, you don't want to destroy what's most valuable for each person, what they most, gives them most meaning in life or purpose or something. So it's a championing of not harming, the Buddha's response. Not necessarily only seeing yourself as being dear. But to not harm anyone, I like to think of it as being not harming oneself and not harming others. We ourselves, since we hold ourselves dear, you wouldn't want to harm yourself. And this is one of the functions of mindfulness practice, is to learn how to pay attention carefully enough in oneself that one learns how not to harm oneself. For some people who start mindfulness meditation, it's a shock to discover how much they do harm themselves. They had no idea that how the self-talk and the attachments and the clinging and the aversion and even the hostility that it can, self-criticism that can live in here, how strong it can be. And then the practice of mindfulness, hopefully, is a practice of healing that and learning how to no longer do that and to see oneself as one's own best friend, to see oneself kindly, with love, with care, and to have a certain kind of self-love or self-treasuring that goes on here. What's going on here is important, partly because the alternative for most people is to cause harm. And so we want to step back from the ways in which we strain, cling, hold on, resist, criticize, attack, blame, the whole list of things that we're greedy, ambitious in ways that cause harm to ourselves. And and so in doing this, we learn about how we do these things. As we learn these things, the kind of the common denominator of all of it is a mind that's fixated. A mind that's preoccupied and caught. It's caught in all those concerns. To learn to relax the mind and to trust just being present without preoccupation, without trying to fix anything, get away from anything, destroy anything, but just to really see and to use the ability to be mindful, ability of attention, to really see clearly enough, really clearly, in the clarity we find the freedom. Not the freedom that requires something to go away, but the freedom from not being fixated on it. So the bicycle can roll freely. There's no resistance to it, at least from the brake. And so this idea of caring for oneself so that we can not harm ourselves is an important part of this light that we're developing. Is that selfish to do that, to have that kind of concern? My argument is that to be selfish is to harm oneself. Self-preoccupation is self-harm. It's not always easy to see. Occasionally I meet people where I think, because sometimes they sound like very good practitioners, and they can talk well about mindfulness, but I listen to them, and very occasionally, I meet some people, and I bet that person's actually narcissistic, which is a powerful, you know, term, right? It's all about themselves here, And they're doing the practice, but they're really building us, kind of supporting this narcissistic self. It's quite. Then it's. I find it very hard to be in communication with people because they're saying a lot of the right things about practice, but my mind is like this. But this is not. This is not freedom. It's not moving towards it. It's going in the opposite direction. But generally, when there's a lot of mindfulness, it tends to highlight the selfishness because selfishness hurts. It's a kind of a tightening or a resistance or a narrowing or a darkening. It doesn't feel good. So this movement, this inner focus of caring for oneself, caring for the quality of one's inner life, can't be selfish. It can be selfish, but selfishness is not sustainable if we're paying very, very careful attention and really looking at it. And so then, so as we do that, there's this light that is discovered. We discover, we have knowledge of this freedom of awareness. And that's the first of the great three tasks. First is to discover the light, the inner light of awareness that's free. The second big task is to become the light, to so be centered in it that it's almost as if we become the light, though you wouldn't necessarily use that language, I'm not the light, because that's just extra. But it's, you know, it's the home, it's a place we trust, it's kind of like, yes, here. The third task is to take that light of freedom and shine it onto the world. And it goes in two directions. The world is, you know, from the vantage point of our awareness, the world is in two directions. One direction is inward, and one is outward. And this is where I think the path of freedom, the mindfulness, that when the mindfulness has discovered some degree of freedom, this is when the practice gets really rich and more challenging. And that is, how do we take this freedom, the sense of free awareness that's spacious and open and not caught by anything, and how do we use it now to look within us in the places we're caught, still caught, the places we are preoccupied, the places where there's difficult emotions, places where we, you know, it's easy to be caught because what we're thinking about or trying to figure out is actually important to deal with. We can't just kind of blissfully ignore everything. And life is complicated. So how do we turn this light inward to see how we're caught, how we're preoccupied, how things are a struggle for us, and to meet that and have the meeting of freedom and the inner difficulties we have? And ideally, these two will meet. I kind of like to think of it as meet so they fit like a glove and a hand. That they just, there's a perfect fit between our freedom and what's going on inside of us. And what I mean by perfect fit is that there's complete honesty about ourselves. And we're willing to be completely present for whatever is challenging within us as if it's okay. As if you're your best friend, and you're there to listen and non-judgmentally, as if you care for what's there in a supportive way, so that your awareness kind of fits the inner challenges you have. You're there willing to meet it and be with it. That you're not using awareness and freedom to ignore what's going on inside. You're using it to meet. There it is. To take that light of freedom and shine it outwards is to attempt to do the same thing in the world around us. To really be present for the world, to meet it, to live in the world as if the world is a perfect fit with the hand and the glove. That is a perfect fit to be in this world as we are. And in awareness. And so there's all these difficulties in the world, plenty of difficulties to encounter and challenges. And mindfulness doesn't fix the challenges. The liberated mind doesn't fix challenges. But ideally, it can meet the challenges or try to meet the challenges and stay free. Once we know something about the light, then we try to use the light and keep the light on in the challenges we discover. Once we know something about inner freedom, a mind that's not preoccupied, not caught, then we try to shine it on the places we're caught, on the difficulties in the world. Try to look at the challenges in all directions. And now, what does it mean not to be caught in this? What does it mean to be present, to fit like a glove in a hand, to really be there for it? But what does it mean to be free here? And if I can find my freedom here, can I then find how best to engage or know what to do, or if nothing else, how not to make the situation worse? So, to not give yourself away is to not to lose what's most precious inside, to not lose the capacity for freedom and this love and care that can exist in here. Each person is most dear to themselves. Each person is valuable and important. Don't give yourself away for any cause. Rather, engage in all kinds of causes if you're inspired, but do it with your freedom, not by giving away what's most precious inside. It's so easy to kind of lean forward or close down. And what we're doing is we're losing touch with this inner light, this inner freedom. It's so easy. And that's why with parents and children, I've discovered, and I have two kids, how easy it was for me, when the kids were small especially, to kind of lean towards them and want so much for them and want to care for them, or every little drama was the most important one in the world. And I had to kind of keep working and exploring, where's my freedom here? How do I be here with this? And it was a tough ride for a little while, being a parent. I'm not saying it was easy, but that was the task, was how to do this without giving myself away to my children. And that, don't give up on oneself. Never give up on oneself. There's this beautiful path of practice that we can walk and engage in, of mindfulness and concentration and compassion and care, that we can discover what's beautiful inside. We can discover that it's okay or appropriate to love oneself, to care for oneself, to hold oneself dear. There is something incredibly beautiful inside. Just like the Buddha said, the foremost light in the world is the light of wisdom, or this inner knowledge of freedom. The most beautiful thing that I know in the universe, and I haven't been many places in the universe, but in the places that I've seen so far, the most beautiful thing that I know that exists is a liberated mind. Nothing is as exquisitely beautiful. And to discover that inner beauty and that inner capacity for love and compassion and wonderful qualities, don't give up on yourself. It's worthwhile to be on the path to find that. Find that light. Once you find the light, become the light. Once you become the light, please shine that light on the world. And then, because the world needs lots of light. And one of the beautiful, beautiful things is when two people who have this really good light shine it on each other. That to have that meeting of free minds, or minds that are practicing freedom, it's a beautiful thing. So thank you for practicing here. For those of you who have been practicing here over these last year, or started to come here this year, thank you for sharing that, and hopefully you find the meeting here, a little bit of fellow practitioners and their interest. And as we begin now this new whole moving towards the light, each day you might notice that it's getting light earlier and dark later. You might use, if you notice that, you might use that as a little reminder that maybe, just maybe, maybe as slowly as the changing lights of each day, maybe your own inner light can grow so it becomes bigger and stronger. May the light of freedom and compassion live in you. Thank you.